As they passed exit 12, a man in a station wagon, which bore a Keep It at 50 bumper sticker, honked 3 times and blipped his lights indignantly. He gave the station wagon the finger. With her eyes still closed, she said,
"You're going too fast. That's why they're honking."
"I know why they're doing it."
"But you don't care."
"No."
"Just another concerned citizen," she intoned, "doing his part to rid America of the energy squeeze."
"I don't give a tin weasel about the energy squeeze."
"So say we. So say we all."
"I used to drive a 55 on the turnpike. No more, no less. That's where my car got the best mileage. Now I'm protesting the trained dog ethic. Surely you read about it in your sociology courses. Or am I wrong? I took it for granted you were a college kid." She sat up.
"I was a sociology major for a while. Well, sort of. But I never heard of the trained dog ethic."
"That's because I made it up."
"Oh, April Fool."
Disgust. She slid back down in the seat and tilted the watch cap over her eyes again. The trained dog ethic, first advanced by Barton George Dawes in late 1973, fully explains such mysteries as the monetary crisis, inflation, the Vietnam War, and the current energy crisis. Let us take the energy crisis as an example. The American people are the trained dogs, trained in this case to love oil-guzzling toys, cars, snowmobiles, large boats, dune buggies, motorcycles, minicycles, campers, and many, many more. In the years 1973 to 1980, we will be trained to hate energy toys. The American people love to be trained. Training makes them wag their tails. Use energy. Don't use energy. Go pee on the newspaper. I don't object to saving energy. I object to training. He found himself thinking of Mr. Piazzi's dog, who had first stopped wagging his tail, had then started rolling his eyes, and had then ripped out Luigi Bronticelli's throat. "Like Pavlov's dogs," he said. "They were trained to salivate at the sound of a bell. We've been trained to salivate when somebody shows us a Bombardier Skidoo with overdrive, or a Zenith color TV with a motorized antenna. I have one of those in my house. The TV has a Space Command gadget. You can sit in your chair and change the channels, hike the volume or lower it, turn it on or off. I stuck the gadget in my mouth once and pushed the on button, and the TV came right on. The signal went right through my brain and still did the job. Technology is wonderful."
"You're crazy," she said.
"I guess so." They passed exit 11.
"I think I'll go to sleep. Tell me when we get to the end."
"Okay." She folded her arms and closed her eyes again. They passed exit 10. "It isn't the trained dog ethic I object to anyway," he said. "It's the fact that the masters are mental, moral, and spiritual idiots."
"You're trying to soothe your conscience with a lot of rhetoric," she said with her eyes still closed. "Why don't you just slow down to 50? You'll feel better."
"I will not feel better." And he sped it out so vehemently that she sat up and looked at him.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fine," he said. "I lost my wife and my job because either the world has gone crazy or I have. Then I'd pick up a hitchhiker, a 19-year-old kid, for Christ's sake, the kind that's supposed to take it for granted that the world's gone crazy, and she tells me it's me. The world is doing just fine. Not much oil, but other than that, just fine."
"I'm 21.
"Good for you," he said bitterly. "If the world's so sane, what's a kid like you doing hitchhiking to Las Vegas in the middle of winter? Planning to spend the whole night hitchhiking along Route 7 and probably getting frostbite in your legs because you're not wearing anything under those pants."
"I am so wearing something underneath. What do you think I am?"
"I think you're stupid," he roared at her. "You're going to freeze your ass off."
"And then you won't be able to get a piece of it, right?"
she inquired sweetly. "Oh, boy," he muttered. "Oh, boy." They roared past the sedan, moving at 50. The sedan beeped at him. "Eat it," he yelled. "Raw!"
"I think you better let me off right now," she said quietly.
"Never mind," he said. "I'm not going to crash us up. Go to sleep.
She looked at him distrustfully for a long second, then folded her arms and closed her eyes. They went past exit 9. They passed exit 2 at 4:05. The shadows stretching across the road had taken on the peculiar blue cast that is the sole property of winter shadows. Venus was already in the east. The traffic had thickened as they approached the city. He glanced over toward her and saw she was sitting up, looking out at their hurrying, indifferent automobiles. The car directly in front of them had a Christmas tree lashed to its roof rack. The girl's green eyes were very wide, and for a moment he fell into them and saw out of them in the perfect empathy that comes to human beings at mercifully infrequent intervals. He saw that all the cars were going to some place where it was warm, some place where there was business to transact or friends to greet or a loom of family life to pick up and stitch upon. He saw their indifference to strangers. He understood in a brief, cold instant of comprehension what Thomas Carlyle called the great dead locomotive of the world, rushing on and on.
"We're almost there?" she asked.
15 minutes.
"Listen, if I was hard on you..."
"No, I was hard on you. Listen, I've got nothing in particular to do. I'll take you around to Landy."
"No."
"Or I'll stick you in the Holiday Inn for the night. No strings attached. Merry Christmas and all that."
"Are you really separated from your wife?"
"Yes."
"And so recently?"
"Yes."
"Has she got your kids?"
"We have no kids." They were coming up on the toll booths. Their green go-lights twinkled indifferently in the early twilight.
"Take me home with you, then."
"I don't have to do that. I mean, you don't have to."
"I'd just as soon be with somebody tonight," she said. "And I don't like to hitchhike at night. It's scary."
He slid up to a toll booth and rolled down his window, letting in cold air. He gave the toll taker his card and $1.90. He pulled out slowly. They passed the reflectorized sign that said, "Thank you for driving safely."
"All right," he said cautiously. He knew he was probably wrong to keep trying to reassure her, probably achieving just the opposite effect, but he couldn't seem to help it. "Listen, it's just that the house is very lonely by myself. We can have supper, and then maybe watch TV and eat popcorn. You can have the upstairs bedroom, and I'll..." She laughed a little, and he glanced at her as they went around the clover leaf. But she was hard to see now, a little indistinct. She could have been something he dreamed. The idea bothered him.
"Listen," she said, "I better tell you this right now. That drunk I was riding with, I spent the night with him. He was going on to Stilson, where you picked me up. That was his price."
He paused for the red light at the foot of the clover leaf.
"My roommate told me it would be like that, but I didn't believe her. I wasn't going to fuck my way across the country, not me."
She looked at him fleetingly, but he still couldn't read her face in the gloom.
"But it's not people making you. It's being so disconnected from everything, like spacewalking. When you come into a big city and think of all the people in there, you want to cry. I don't know why, but you do. It gets so you'd spend the night picking some guy's bleeding pimples just to hear him breathe and talk."
"I don't care who you've been sleeping with," he said, and pulled out into traffic. Automatically, he turned onto Grand Street, heading for home past the 784 construction.
"This salesman," she said, "he's been married 14 years. He kept saying that while he was humping me. 14 years, Sharon, he keeps saying. 14 years, 14 years. He came in about 14 seconds.
She uttered a short bark of laughter, rueful and sad.
"Is that your name, Sharon?"
"No. I guess that was his wife's name."
He pulled over to the curb.
"What are you doing?"
she asked, instantly distrustful.
"Nothing much," he said. "This is part of going home. Get out if you want. I'll show you something."
They got out and walked over to the observation platform, now deserted. He laid his bare hands on the cold iron pipe of the railing and looked down. They had been undercoating today, he saw. The last 3 working days they had put down gravel. Now undercoat. Deserted equipment, trucks and bulldozers and yellow backhoes, stood silently about in the shades of evening like a museum exhibit of dinosaurs. Here we have the vegetarian Stegosaurus, the flesh-eating Triceratops, the fearsome earth-munching diesel shovel. Bon appetit. What do you think of it? He asked her.
Am I supposed to think something?
She was fencing, trying to figure this out.
You must think something, he said.
She shrugged.
It's road work. So what? They're building a road in a city I'll probably never be in again. What am I supposed to think? It's ugly.
Ugly, he echoed, relieved.
I grew up in Portland, Maine, she said. We lived in a big apartment building, and they put this shopping center up across the street.
Did they tear anything down to make it?
Huh?
Did they?
Oh, no. It was just a vacant lot with a big field behind it. I was just 6 or 7. I thought they were going to go on digging and ripping and plowing forever, and all I could think, it's funny, all I could think was the poor old earth. It's like they're giving it an enema, and they never asked if it wanted one or if there was something wrong. I had some kind of an intestinal infection that year, and I was the block expert on enemas.
Oh, he said.
We went over one Sunday when they weren't working, and it was a lot like this. Very quiet, like a corpse that died in bed. They had part of the foundations laid, and there were all these yellow metal things sticking out of the cement.
Core rods.
Whatever. And there was lots of pipe and bundles of wire covered with clear plastic wrap. And there was a lot of raw dirt around. Funny to think of it that way. Whoever heard of cooked dirt? But that's how it looked. Just raw. We played hide-and-go-seek around the place, and my mother came over and got us and gave me and my sister hell for it. She said little kids can get into bad trouble around construction. My little sister was only 4, and she cried her head off. Funny to remember all that. Can we get back in the car now? I'm cold.
Sure, he said, and they did.
As they drove on, she said,
I never thought they'd have anything out of that place but a mess. Then pretty soon the shopping center was all there. I can remember the day they hot-topped the parking lot. And a few days after that, some men came with a little push wagon and made all the yellow parking lines. Then they had a big party, and some hot shit cut a ribbon, and everybody started using it. And it was just like they never built it. The name of the big department store was Mammoth Mart, and my mom used to go there a lot. Sometimes when Angie and I were with her, I'd think of all those orange rods sticking through the cement down in the basement. It was like a secret thought.
He nodded. He knew about secret thoughts.
What does it mean to you? She asked.
I'm still trying to figure that out, he said.
He was going to make TV dinners, but she looked in the freezer and saw the roast and said she'd fix it if he didn't mind waiting for it to cook.
Sure, he said. I didn't know how long to cook in, or even what temperature.
Do you miss your wife?
Like hell.
Because you don't know how to cook the roast? She asked.
And he didn't answer that. She baked potatoes and cooked frozen corn. They ate in the breakfast nook, and she ate 4 thick slices of the roast, 2 potatoes and 2 helpings of corn.
I haven't eaten like that in a year, she said,
lighting a cigarette and looking into her empty plate.
I'll probably heave my guts.
What have you been eating?
Animal crackers.
What?
Animal crackers.
I thought that's what you said.
They're cheap, she said, and they fill you up. They've got a lot of nutrients and stuff, too. It says so right in the box.
Nutrients, my ass. You're getting zits, girl. You're too old for those. Come here.
He led her into the dining room and opened Mary's china cupboard. He took out a silver serving dish and pulled a thick pile of paper money out of it. Her eyes widened.
Who'd you off, mister?
I offed my insurance policy. Here's $200. Eat on it.
but she didn't touch the money.
"You're nuts," she said. "What do you think I'm going to do to you for $200?
"Nothing." She laughed.
"All right." He put the money on the sideboard and put the silver serving dish back into the cupboard. "If you don't take it with you in the morning, I'll flush it down the John." But he didn't think he would.
She looked into his face. "You know, I think you would."
He said nothing.
"We'll see," she said, "in the morning."
"In the morning," he echoed. He was watching To Tell the Truth on the television. Two of the contestants were lying about being the world's champion female bronc rider, and one was telling the truth. The panel, which included Soupy Sales, Bill Cullen, Arlene Dahl, and Kitty Carlisle, had to guess which one was telling the truth. Gary Moore, television's only 300-year-old game show host, smiled and cracked jokes and dinged a bell when each panelist's time was up. The girl was looking out the window.
"Hey," she said, "who lives on this street anyway? All the houses look dark."
"Me and the Dankmans," he said. "And the Dankmans are moving out January 5th.
"Why?"
"The road," he said. "Would you like a drink?"
"What do you mean, the road?"
"It's coming through here," he said. "This house is going to be somewhere in the middle of the median strip, as near as I can figure."
"That's why you showed me the construction?"
"I guess so. I used to work for a laundry about 2 miles from here. The Blue Ribbon. It's going through there, too."
"That's why you lost your job? Because the laundry was closing?"
"Not exactly. I was supposed to sign an option on a new plant in a suburb called Waterford, and I didn't do it."
"Why not?"
"I couldn't bear to," he said simply. "You want a drink?"
"You don't have to get me drunk," she said.
"Oh, Christ," he said, rolling his eyes. "Your mind runs on just one track, doesn't it?" There was a moment of uncomfortable silence.
"Screwdrivers are about the only drinks I like. Do you have vodka and orange juice?"
"Yes."
"No pot, I guess."
"No, I've never used it." He went out into the kitchen and made her a screwdriver. He mixed himself a Comfort and 7-Up and took them back into the living room. She was playing with the Space Command gadget, and the TV switched from channel to channel, displaying its 7:30 wares, To Tell the Truth, Snow, What's My Line, I Dream of Jeannie, Gilligan's Island, Snow, I Love Lucy, Snow, Snow, Julia Child making something with avocados that looked a little like dog whoop, The New Price is Right, Snow, and then back to Gary Moore, who was daring the panel to discover which of the three contestants was the real author of a book about what it was like to be lost for a month in the forests of Saskatchewan. He gave her her drink.
"Did you eat beetles, number two?" Kitty Carlisle asked. "What's the matter with you people?" the girl asked. "No Star Trek. Are you heathens?"
"They run it at 4 o'clock on Channel 8," he said.
"Do you watch it?"
"Sometimes. My wife always watches Merv Griffin."
"I didn't see any beetles," number two said. "If I'd seen any, I would have eaten them."
The audience laughed heartily.
"Why did she move out? You don't have to tell me if you don't want to."
She looked at him warily, as if the price of his confession might be tiresomely high. "The same reason I got fired off my job," he said, sitting down.
"Because you didn't buy that plant?"
"No, because I didn't buy a new house."
"I voted for number two," Soupy Sales said, "because he looks like he'd eat a beetle if he saw one."
The audience laughed heartily.
"Didn't? Wow. Oh, wow."
She looked at him over her drink without blinking. The expression in her eyes seemed to be a mixture of awe, admiration, and terror.
"Where are you going to go?"
"I don't know."
"You're not working?"
"No."
"What do you do all day?"
"I ride on the turnpike."
"And watch TV at night?"
"And drink. Sometimes I make popcorn.
I'm going to make popcorn later on tonight.
I don't eat popcorn.
Then I'll eat it.
She punched the off button on the space command gadget. He sometimes thought of it as a module, because today you were encouraged to think of everything that zapped on and off as a module. And the picture on the zenith twinkled down to a bright dot and then winked out.
Let me see if I've got this straight, she said. You threw your wife and your job down the drain.
But not necessarily in that order.
Whatever. You threw them away over this road. Is that right?
He looked at the blank TV uncomfortably. Even though he rarely followed what was happening on it very closely, it made him uncomfortable to have it off.
I don't know if it is or not, he said. You can't always understand something just because you did it.
Was it a protest?
I don't know. If you're protesting something, it's because you think something else would be better. All those people protested the war because they thought peace would be better. People protest drug laws because they think other drug laws would be fairer or more fun or less harm or... I don't know. Why don't you turn the TV on?
In a minute.
He noticed again how green her eyes were. Intent. Cat-like.
Is it because you hate the road? The technological society it represents? The dehumanizing effect of...
No, he said.
It was so difficult, to be honest, and he wondered why he was even bothering when a lie would end the discussion so much more quickly and neatly. She was like the rest of the kids, like Vinny, like the people who thought education was truth. She wanted propaganda, complete with charts, not an answer.
I've seen them building roads and buildings all my life. I never even thought about it. Except it was a pain in the ass to use a detour or have to cross the street because the sidewalk was ripped up or the construction company was using a wrecking ball.
But when it hit home, to your house and your job, you said no.
I said no, all right.
But he wasn't sure what he had said no to. Or had he said yes? Yes. Finally, yes to some destructive impulse that had been part of him all along. As much a built-in self-destruct mechanism as Charlie's tumor. He found himself wishing Freddy would come around. Freddy could tell her what she wanted to hear, but Fred had been playing it cool.
You're either crazy or really remarkable, she said.
People are only remarkable in books, he said. Let's have the TV.
She turned it on. He let her pick the show.
What are you drinking?
It was 9:15. He was tipsy, but not as drunk as he would have been by now alone. He was making popcorn in the kitchen. He liked to watch it pop in the tempered glass popper, rising and rising like snow that had sprung up from the ground rather than come down from the sky.
Southern Comfort and 7-Up, he said.
What?
He chuckled, embarrassed.
Can I try one?
She showed him her empty glass and grinned. It was the first completely unself-conscious expression she had shown him since he had picked her up.
You make a lousy screwdriver.
I know, he said. Comfort and 7-Up is my private drink. In public, I stick to scotch. Hate scotch.
The popcorn was done, and he poured it into a large plastic bowl.
Can I have one?
Sure.
He mixed her a Comfort and 7-Up, then poured a melted stick of butter over the popcorn.
That's going to put a lot of cholesterol in your bloodstream, she said,
leaning on the doorway between the kitchen and the dining room. She sipped her drink.
Hey, I like this.
Sure you do. Keep it a secret, and you'll always be one up.
He salted the popcorn.
That cholesterol clogs up your heart, she said. The passageways for the blood get smaller and smaller, and then one day...
She clutched dramatically at her bosom and spilled some of her drink on her sweater.
I metabolize it all away, he told her,
and went through the doorway. He brushed her breast, primly broad by the feel, on the way by. It felt a way Mary's breast hadn't felt in years. It was maybe not such a good way to think.
She ate most of the popcorn.
She started to yawn during the 11 o'clock news, which was mostly about the energy crisis and the White House tapes.
"Go on upstairs," he said. "Go to bed."
She gave him a look.
He said, "We're going to get along good if you stop looking like somebody goosed you every time the word bed comes up. The primary purpose of the great American bed is sleeping, not intercoursing." That made her smile.
"You don't even want to turn down the sheets?"
"You're a big girl."
She looked at him calmly.
"You can come up with me if you want," she said. "I decided that an hour ago."
"No, but you don't have any idea how attractive the invitation is. I've only slept with 3 women in my entire life, and the first 2 were so long ago I can hardly remember them, before I was married."
"Are you kidding?"
"Not at all."
"Listen, it wouldn't be just because you gave me a ride or let me sleep over or anything like that, or the money you offered."
"It's good of you to say that," he said, and got up. "You better go up now."
But she didn't follow his suit.
"You ought to know why you're not doing it."
"I should?"
"Yes. If you do things and can't explain them, like you said, that might be okay because they still get done. But if you decide not to, you ought to know why."
"All right," he said.
He nodded toward the dining room where the money still lay in the silver dish.
"It's the money. You're too young to be off whoring."
"I won't take it,"
she said promptly.
"I know you won't. That's why I won't. I want you to take it."
"Because everybody isn't as nice as you?"
"That's right."
He looked at her challengingly. She shook her head in an exasperated way and stood up.
"All right. But you're a bourgeois, you know that?"
"Yes."
She came over and kissed him on the mouth. It was exciting. He could smell her, and the smell was nice. He was almost instantly hard.
"Go on," he said.
"If you reconsider during the night..."
"I won't."
He watched her go to the stairs, her feet bare.
"Hey."
She turned, her eyebrows raised.
"What's your name?"
"Olivia, if it matters. Stupid, isn't it? Like Olivia de Havilland."
"No, it's okay. I like it. Night, Olivia."
"Night."
She went up. He heard the light click on, the way he had always heard it when Mary went up before him. If he listened closely, he might be able to hear the quietly maddening sound of her sweater against her skin as she pulled it up over her head, or the snap of the catch that held her jeans nipped into her waist. Using the Space Command module, he turned on the TV. His penis was still fully erect, uncomfortable. It bulged against the crotch of his pants, what Mary had sometimes called the rock of ages and sometimes the snake that turned to stone in their younger days, when bed was nothing but another playground sport. He pulled at the folds of his underwear, and when it didn't go down, he stood up. After a while, the erection wilted, and he sat down again. When the news was over, a movie came on, John Agar in Brain from Planet Eros. He fell asleep, sitting in front of the TV with the Space Command module still clasped loosely in one hand. A few minutes later, there was a stirring beneath the fly of his pants as his erection returned, stealthily, like a murderer revisiting the scene of an ancient crime. December 7, 1973. But he did go to her in the night. The dream of Mr. Piazzi's dog came to him. And this time he knew the boy approaching the dog was Charlie before the bitch struck. That made it worse. And when Mr. Piazzi's dog lunged, he struggled up from sleep like a man clawing his way out of a shallow, sandy grave. He clawed at the air, not awake but not asleep either. And he lost his sense of balance on the couch, where he had finally curled up. He tottered miserably on the edge of balance for a moment, disoriented. Terrified for his dead son who died over and over again in his dreams. He fell onto the floor, banging his head and hurting his shoulder, and came awake enough to know he was in his own living room and that the dream was over. The reality was miserable, but not actively terrifying. What was he doing? A sort of gestalt reality of what he had done to his life came to him, a hideous overview. He had ripped it right down the middle, like a cheap piece of cloth, Nothing was right anymore. He was hurting. He could taste stale southern comfort in the back of his throat, and he burped up some acid-tasting sour stuff and swallowed it back. He began to shiver and seized his knees in a futile effort to stop it. In the night, everything was strange. What was he doing? Sitting on the floor of his living room and holding his knees and shaking like an old drunk in an alley? Or like a catatonic, a fucking psycho, that was more like it. Was that it? Was he a psycho? Nothing sort of funny and whimsical like a fruitcake or a dork or a rubber crutch, but an out-and-out psycho? The thought dumped him into fresh terror. Had he gone to a hoodlum in an effort to get explosives? Was he really hiding two guns out in the garage, one of them big enough to kill an elephant? A little whining noise came out of his throat, and he got up, tentatively, his bones creaking like those of a very old man. He went up the stairs without allowing himself to think, and stepped into his bedroom. "Olivia," he whispered. This was preposterous, like an old-time Rudolph Valentino movie. "Are you awake?"
"Yes," she said. She didn't even sound sleepy. "The clock was keeping me awake. That digital clock. It kept going click. I pulled the plug."
"That's all right," he said. It was a ludicrous thing to say. "I had a bad dream." The sound of covers being thrown back.
"Come on. Get in with me."
"I..."
"Will you shut up?"
He got in with her. She was naked. They made love. Then slept. In the morning, the temperature was only 10 degrees. She asked him if he got a newspaper. "We used to," he said. "Kenny Upslinger delivered it. His family moved to Iowa."
"Iowa yet?" she said, and turned on the radio.
A man was giving the weather, clear and cold. "Would you like a fried egg?"
"2, if you've got them."
"Sure. Listen, about last night..."
"Never mind last night. I came. That's very rare for me. I enjoyed it."
He felt a certain sneaking pride, maybe what she had wanted him to feel. He fried the eggs, 2 for her, 2 for him. Toast and coffee. She drank 3 cups with cream and sugar.
"So, what are you going to do?"
she asked him when they had both finished. "Take you out to the highway," he said promptly. She made an impatient gesture.
"Not that. About your life."
He grinned. "That sounds serious."
"Not for me," she said. "For you."
"I haven't thought about it," he said. "You know, before..." He accented the word before slightly, to indicate all of his life and all of its parts he had sailed off the edge of the world. "Before the axe fell, I think I must have felt the way some condemned man feels in the death house. Nothing seemed real. It seemed I was living in a glass dream that would go on and on. Now, everything seems real. Last night, that was very real."
"I'm glad," she said, and she looked glad. "But what will you do now?"
"I really don't know." She said,
"I think that's sad."
"Is it?" he asked. It was a real question. They were in the car again, driving Route 7 toward Landy. The traffic near the city was stop and go. People were on their way to work. When they passed the construction on the 784 extension, the day's operation was already cranking up. Men in yellow high-impact plastic construction hats and green rubber boots were climbing into their machines, frozen breath pluming from their mouths. The engine of one of the armed city payloaders cranked, cranked, kicked over with a coughing mortar explosion sound, cranked again, then roared into a choppy idle. The driver gunned it in irregular bursts like the sound of warfare.
"From up here, they look like little boys playing trucks in a sand pile," she said.
Outside the city, traffic smoothed out. She had taken the $200 with neither embarrassment nor reluctance, with no special eagerness, either. She had slit a small section of the CPO coat's lining, had put the bills inside, and had then sewed the slit back up with a needle and some blue thread from Mary's sewing box. She had refused his offer of a ride to the bus station, saying the money would last longer if she went on hitching.
"So what's a nice girl like you doing in a car like this?" he asked.
"Hmm?"
She looked at him, bumped out of her own thoughts. He smiled.
"Why you? Why Las Vegas? You're living in the margins, same as me. Give me some background."
She shrugged.
"There isn't much. I was going to college at the University of New Hampshire, in Durham. That's near Portsmouth. I was a junior this year, living off campus, with a guy. We got into a heavy drug thing."
"You mean, like, heroin?"
She laughed merrily.
"No, I've never known anyone who did heroin. Us nice middle-class druggies stick to the hallucinogens, lysergic acid, mescaline, peyote a couple of times, STP a couple of times, chemicals. I did 16 or 18 trips between September and November."
"What's it like?" he asked.
"Do you mean, did I have any bad trips?"
"No, I didn't mean that at all," he said defensively.
"There were some bad trips, but they all had good parts. And a lot of the good trips had bad parts. Once I decided I had leukemia, that was scary. But mostly they were just strange. I never saw God. I never wanted to commit suicide. I never tried to kill anyone."
She thought that over for a minute.
"Everybody has hyped the shit out of those chemicals. The straights, people like Art Linkletter, say they'll kill you. The freaks say they'll open all the doors you need to open, like you can find a tunnel into the middle of yourself, as if your soul was like the treasure in an H. Rider Haggard novel. Have you ever read him?"
"I read She when I was a kid. Didn't he write that?"
"Yes. Do you think your soul is like an emerald in the middle of an idol's forehead?"
"I never thought about it."
"I don't think so,"
she said.
"I'll tell you the best and the worst that ever happened to me on chemicals. The best was topping out in the apartment one time and watching the wallpaper. There were all these little round dots on the wallpaper, and they turned into snow for me. I sat in the living room and watched the snowstorm on the wall for better than an hour. And after a while, I saw this little girl trudging through the snow. She had a kerchief on her head, a very rough material like burlap, and she was holding it like this."
She made a fist under her chin.
"I decided she was going home, and bang! I saw a whole street in there, all covered with snow. She went up the street, and then up a walk, and into a house. That was the best, sitting in the apartment and watching Wall-O-Vision, except Jeff called it Head-O-Vision."
"Was Jeff the guy you were living with?"
"Yes. The worst trip was one time I decided to plunge out the sink. I didn't know why. You get funny ideas sometimes when you're tripping, except they seem perfectly normal. It seemed like I had to plunge the sink. So I got the plunger and did it. And all this shit came out of the drain. I still don't know how much of it was real shit and how much was head shit. Coffee grounds, an old piece of shirt, great big hunks of congealed grease, red stuff that looked like blood, and then the hand, some guy's hand."
What?
"A hand. I called to Jeff and said, 'Hey, somebody put somebody down the drain.' But he had taken off someplace and I was alone. I plunged like hell and finally got the forearm out. The hand was lying on the porcelain, all spotted with coffee grounds, and there was the forearm going right down the drain. I went into the living room for a minute to see if Jeff had come back, and when I went into the kitchen again, the arm and the hand was gone. It sort of worried me. Sometimes I dream about it."
"That's crazy," he said,
slowing down as they crossed the bridge that was under construction.
"Chemicals make you crazy," she said. "Sometimes that's a good thing. Mostly it isn't. Anyway, we were into this heavy drug thing. Have you ever seen one of those drawings of what an atom looks like? With the protons and neutrons and electrons going around?"
"Yes."
"Well, it was like our apartment was the nucleus, and all the people who drifted in and out were the protons and electrons. People coming and going, drifting in and out, all disconnected. Like in Manhattan Transfer."
"I haven't read that one.
You ought to. Jeff always said Dos Passos was the original Gonzo journalist. Freaky book. Anyway, some nights we'd be sitting around watching TV with the sound shut off and a record on the stereo. Everyone stoned, people bawling in the bedroom, maybe. And you wouldn't even know who the fuck everyone was, you know what I mean?
Thinking of some of the parties he had wandered drunkenly through, as bemused as Alice in Wonderland, he said that he did.
So one night, there was a Bob Hope special on. And everybody was sitting around, all smoked up, laughing like hell at all those old one-liners. All those same stock expressions. All that good-natured kidding of the power crazes in Washington. Just sitting around the tube like all the mommies and daddies back home. And I thought, well, that's what we went through Vietnam for. So Bob Hope could close the generation gap. It's just a question of how you're getting high.
But you were too pure for all that.
Pure? No, that wasn't it. But I started to think of the last 15 years or so like some kind of grotesque monopoly game. Francis Gary Powers gets shut down in his U2, lose one turn. Niggers dispersed by fire hoses in Selma go directly to jail. Freedom Riders shotgunned in Mississippi, marches, rallies, Lester Maddox with his axe handle, Kennedy getting blown up in Dallas, Vietnam, more marches, Kent State, student strikes, women's liberation, and all for what? So a bunch of heads can sit around stoned in a crummy apartment, watching Bob Hope? Fuck that. So I decided to split.
What about Jeff?
She shrugged.
He has a scholarship. He's doing good. He says he's going to come out next summer, but I won't look for him until I see him.
There was a peculiar disillusioned expression on her face that probably felt like hearty forbearance on the inside.
Do you miss him?
Every night.
Why Vegas? Do you know someone out there?
No.
It seems like a funny place for an idealist.
Is that what you think I am?
She laughed and lit a cigarette.
Maybe. But I don't think an ideal needs any particular setting. I want to see that city. It's so different from the rest of the country that it must be good. But I'm not going to gamble. I'm just going to get a job.
Then what?
She blew out smoke and shrugged. They were passing a sign that said, Landy, 5 miles.
Try to get something together,
she said.
I'm not going to put any dope in my head for a long time, and I'm going to quit these.
She gestured her cigarette in the air, and it made an accidental circle, as if it knew a different truth.
I'm going to stop pretending my life hasn't started yet. It has. It's 20% over. I've drunk the cream.
Look, there's the turnpike entrance. He pulled over to the side.
What about you, man? What are you going to do?
Carefully, he said, see what develops. Keep my options open. She said,
you're not in such hot shape, if you don't mind me saying so.
No, I don't mind.
Here, take this.
She was holding out a small aluminum packet between the first and second fingers of her right hand. He took it and looked at it. The foil caught the bright morning sun and heliographed darts of light at his eyes.
What is it?
Product 4 synthetic mescaline, the heaviest, cleanest chemical ever made. She hesitated. Maybe you should just flush it down the john when you get home. It might fuck you up worse than you are, but it might help. I've heard of it.
Have you ever seen it? She smiled bitterly.
No.
Will you do something for me, if you can?
If I can.
Call me on Christmas Day.
Why?
You're like a book I haven't finished. I want to know how a little more of it comes out. Make it a collect call. Here, I'll write down the number.
He was fumbling a pen out of his pocket when she said,
no.
He looked at her puzzled and hurt.
No.
I can get the number from directory assistance if I need it, but maybe it would be best not to.
Why?
I don't know. I like you, but it's like someone put a hurtin' on you. I can't explain. It's like you were going to do something really bonkers.
You think I'm a fruitcake, he heard himself say. Well, Fuck you.
She got out of the car stiffly. He leaned over. Olivia.
Maybe that's not my name.
Maybe it is. Please call.
Be careful with that stuff, she said, pointing at the little aluminum packet. You're spacewalking, too.
Goodbye. Be careful.
Careful? What's that?
The bitter smile again.
Goodbye, Mr. Dawes. Thanks. You're good in bed. Do you mind me saying that? You are. Goodbye.
She slammed the door closed, crossed Route 7, and stood at the base of the turnpike entrance ramp. He watched her show a thumb to a couple of cars. Neither of them stopped. Then the road was clear and he U-turned, honking once. In the rearview mirror, he saw a small facsimile of her wave.
Silly twit, he thought, stuffed full of every strange conceit in the world. Still, when he put his hand out to turn on the radio, the fingers trembled.
He drove back to the city, got on the turnpike, and drove 200 miles at 70. Once he almost threw the small aluminum packet out the window. Once he almost took the pill inside. At last he just put it in his coat pocket. When he got home, he felt washed out, empty of emotion. The 784 extension had progressed during the day. In a couple of weeks, the laundry would be ready for the wrecking ball. They had already taken out the heavy equipment. Tom Granger had told him about that in an odd, stilted phone conversation 3 nights ago. When they leveled it, he would spend the day watching. He would even pack a bag lunch. There was a letter for Mary from her brother in Jacksonville. He didn't know about the split then. He put it aside absently with some other mail for Mary that he kept forgetting to forward. He put a TV dinner in the oven and thought about making himself a drink. He decided not to. He wanted to think about his sexual encounter with the girl the night before, relish it, explore its nuances. A few drinks and it would take on the unnatural, fevered color of a bad sex movie. Restless co-eds, ID required, and he didn't want to think of her like that. But it wouldn't come. Not the way he wanted it. He couldn't remember the precise tight feel of her breasts, or the secret taste of her nipples. He knew that the actual friction of intercourse had been more pleasurable with her than with Mary. Olivia had been a snugger fit, and once his penis had popped out of her vagina with an audible sound, like the pop of a champagne cork. But he couldn't really say what the pleasure had been. Instead of being able to feel it, he wanted to masturbate. The desire disgusted him. Furthermore, his disgust disgusted him. She wasn't holy, he assured himself as he sat down to eat his TV dinner. Just a tramp on the bum. To Las Vegas, yet. He found himself wishing that he could view the whole incident with Magliore's jaundiced eye, and that disgusted him most of all. Later that night, he got drunk in spite of all his good intentions, and around 10 o'clock the familiar maudlin urge to call Mary rose up in him. He masturbated instead, in front of the TV, and came to climax while an announcer was showing incontrovertibly that Anacin hit and held the highest pain relief level of any brand.
December 8, 1973. He didn't go riding Saturday. He wandered uselessly around the house, putting off the thing that had to be done. At last, he called the home of his in-laws. Lester and Jean Calloway, Mary's parents, were both nearing their 70s. On his previous calls, Jean, who Charlie had always called Mama Jean, had answered the telephone, her voice freezing to ice chips when she realized who was on the line. To her, and to Lester also, undoubtedly, he was like some animal that had run amok and bitten her daughter. Now the animal kept calling up, obviously drunk, whining for their girl to come back so he could bite her again. He heard Mary herself answer,
"Hello?"
with enough relief so he could talk normally. "Me, Mary."
"Oh, Bart. How are you?"
Impossible to read her voice. "Fair."
"How are the Southern Comfort Supplies holding out?"
"Mary, I'm not drinking."
"Is that a victory?"
She sounded cold, and he felt a touch of panic, mostly that his judgment had been impossibly bad. Could someone he had known so long and whom he thought he knew so well be slipping away so easily? "I guess it is," he said lamely.
I understand the laundry had to close down, she said.
Probably just temporary. He had the weird sensation that he was riding in an elevator, conversing uncomfortably with someone who regarded him as a bore.
That isn't what Tom Granger's wife said.
There. Accusation at last. Accusation was better than nothing.
Tom won't have any problem. The competition uptown has been after him for years, the bright, clean people.
He thought she sighed.
Why did you call, Bart?
I think we ought to get together, he said carefully. We have to talk this over, Mary.
Do you mean a divorce?
She said it calmly enough, but he thought it was her voice in which he sensed panic now.
Do you want one?
I don't know what I want.
Her calm fractured, and she sounded angry and scared.
I thought everything was fine. I was happy, and I thought you were. Now all at once, that's all changed.
You thought everything was fine, he replied. He was suddenly furious with her. You must have been pretty stupid if you thought that. Did you think I kicked away my job for a practical joke, like a high school senior throwing a cherry bomb into a toilet?
Then what is it, Bart? What happened?
His anger collapsed like a rotten yellow snowbank, and he found that there were tears beneath. He fought them, grimly, feeling betrayed. This wasn't supposed to happen, sober. When you were sober, you should be able to keep fucking control of yourself, but here he was, wanting to spill out everything and sob on her lap like a kid with a busted skate and a skinned knee. But he couldn't tell her what was wrong because he didn't precisely know, and crying without knowing was too much like it's time for the loony bin stuff.
I don't know, he said finally.
Charlie?
Helplessly, he said,
if that was part of it, how could you be so blind to the rest of it?
I miss him too, Bart. Still. Every day.
Resentment again. You've got a funny way of showing it, then.
This is no good, he said finally.
Tears were trickling down his cheeks, but he had kept them out of his voice.
Gentlemen, I think we've got it licked, he thought, and almost cackled. Not over the phone. I called to suggest lunch on Monday. Handy Andy's.
All right. What time?
It doesn't matter. I can get off work.
The joke fell to the floor and died bloodlessly there.
1 o'clock?
She asked.
Sure. I'll get us a table.
Reserve one. Don't just get there at 11 and start drinking.
I won't, he said humbly,
knowing he probably would. There was a pause. There seemed nothing else to say. Faintly, almost lost in the hum of the open wire, ghostly other voices discussed ghostly other things. Then she said something that surprised him totally.
Bart, you need to see a psychiatrist.
I need a what?
Psychiatrist. I know how that sounds, just coming out flat, but I want you to know that whatever we decide, I won't come back and live with you unless you agree.
Goodbye, Mary, he said slowly. I'll see you on Monday.
Bart, you need help I can't give.
Carefully, inserting the knife as well as he could over 2 miles of blind wire, he said,
I knew that anyway. Goodbye, Mary.
He hung up before he could hear the result and caught himself feeling glad. Game, set, and match. He threw a plastic milk pitcher across the room and caught himself feeling glad that he hadn't thrown something breakable. He opened the cupboard over the sink, yanked out the first 2 glasses his hands came to, and threw them on the floor. They shattered.
Baby, you fucking baby, he screamed at himself. Why don't you just hold your fucking breath until you turn fucking blue?
He slammed his right fist against the wall to shut out the voice and cried out at the pain. He held his wounded right in his left and stood in the middle of the floor, trembling. When he had himself under control, he got a dustpan and the broom and swept the mess up, feeling scared and sullen and hungover. December 9, 1973. He got on the turnpike, drove 150 miles, and then drove back. He didn't dare drive any farther. It was the first gasless Sunday, and all the turnpike pit stops were closed, and he didn't want to walk. See, he told himself, this is how they get shitbirds like you, Georgie.
Fred, is that really you?
To what do I owe the honor of this visit, Freddy?
Fuck off, buddy.
On the way home, he heard this public service ad on the radio.
So you're worried about the gasoline shortage, and you want to make sure that you and your family aren't caught short this winter. So now you're on your way to your neighborhood gas station with a dozen 5-gallon cans. But if you're really worried about your family, you better turn around and go back home. Improper storage of gasoline is dangerous. It's also illegal. But never mind that for a minute. Consider this. When gasoline fumes mix with the air, they become explosive. And 1 gallon of gas has the explosive potential of 12 sticks of dynamite. Think about that before you fill those cans. And then think about your family. You see, we want you to live.
This has been a public service announcement from WLDM. The music people remind you to leave gasoline storage to the people who are equipped to do it properly.
He turned off the radio, slowed down to 50, and pulled back into the cruising lane.
12 sticks of dynamite, he said. Man, that's amazing.
If he had looked into the rearview mirror, he would have seen that he was grinning.
December 10, 1973. He got to Handy Andy's at just past 11:30, and the head waiter gave him a table beside the stylized bat wings that led to the lounge. Not a good table, but one of the few empties left as the place filled up for lunch. Handy Andy's specialized in steaks, chops, and something called the Andy Burger, which looked a little like a chef's salad stuck between a huge sesame seed roll with a toothpick to hold the whole contraption together. Like all big city restaurants within executive walking distance, it went through indefinable cycles of inness and outness. 2 months ago, he could have come in here at noon and had his pick of tables. 3 months hence, he might be able to do the same. To him, it had always been one of life's minor mysteries, like the incidents in the books of Charles Fort, or the instinct that always brought the swallows back to Capistrano. He looked around quickly as he sat down, afraid he would see Vinnie Mason or Steve Ordner or some other laundry executive. But the place was stuffed with strangers. To his left, a young man was trying to persuade his girl that they could afford 3 days in Sun Valley this February. The rest of the room's conversation was just soft babble, soothing.
"A drink, sir?"
The waiter was at his elbow.
"Scotch rocks, please," he said.
"Very good, sir," the waiter said.
He made the first one last until noon, killed 2 more by 12:30, and then, just mulishly, he ordered a double. He was just draining it dry when he saw Mary walk in and pause in the door between the foyer and the dining room, looking for him. Heads turned to look at her, and he thought, "Mary, you ought to thank me. You're beautiful." He raised his right hand and waved. She raised her hand in return greeting and came to his table. She was wearing a knee-length wool dress, soft patterned gray. Her hair was braided in a single thick cable that hung down to her shoulder blades, a way he could not recall having seen her wear it, and maybe worn that way for just that reason. It made her look youthful, and he had a sudden guilty flash of Olivia, working beneath him on the bed he and Mary had shared so often.
"Hello, Bart," she said.
"Hi. You look awful pretty."
"Thanks."
"Do you want a drink?"
"No, just an Andy Burger. How long have you been here?"
"Oh, not long."
The lunch crowd had thinned, and his waiter appeared almost at once.
"Would you like to order now, sir?"
"Yes. 2 Andy Burgers, milk for the lady, another double for myself."
He glanced at Mary, but her face showed nothing. That was bad. If she had spoken, he would have canceled the double. He hoped he wouldn't have to go to the bathroom because he wasn't sure he could walk straight.
That would be a wonderful tidbit to carry back to the old folks at home. "Carry me back to old Virginny," he almost giggled.
"Well, you're not drunk, but you're on your way,"
she said, and unfolded her napkin on her lap. "That's pretty good," he said. "Did you rehearse it?"
"Bart, let's not fight."
"No," he agreed.
She toyed with her water glass. He picked at his coaster.
"Well?"
she said finally.
"Well, what?"
"You seem to have something in mind when you called. Now that you're full of Dutch courage, what is it?"
"Your cold is better," he said idiotically, and tore a hole in his coaster without meaning to. He couldn't tell her what was on the top of his mind. How she seemed to have changed,
how she seemed suddenly sophisticated and dangerous, like a